Next, let's meet the man behind one of TV's most memorable shows ever. David Chase created The Sopranos, the HBO show about a neurotic New Jersey family man and mob boss. This morning, he's our latest guest for Watch This, conversations where we get recommendations for movie and TV DVDs. When David Chase spoke to Morning Edition's Steve Inskeep, his first pick was the 1940 movie from comedians Laurel and Hardy called Saps at Sea.
When I was a kid, I used to watch Laurel and Hardy with my cousins all the time. And I just thought they were the funny. I still think they're extremely funny and so surreal. The story of this is that Hardy has some kind of an allergy to horns blowing. And if he hears a horn blow, he starts to go, horns, horns, and he starts freaking out.
Horns! Horns!
They take a sea voyage to help him calm him down. And unbeknownst to them is a gangster, an escaped gangster. And he takes command of the boat. And one of the great scenes is they figure that what they'll do is they'll poison him. They'll make him something. He says, make me something to eat. And they make meatballs out of sponge and spaghetti out of a mop. And they're going to feed that to him. And he will then, of course, you know, be incapacitated.
Sure.
But he makes them eat it.
You're going to like this because it's just like Mother used to make.
Oh, she never made any as good as this.
Well, if it's that good, you eat it.
Well, I'm not a bit hungry, am I, Ollie?
No, and I'm on a diet.
You heard what I said. Eat. Just like Mother used to make, eh, Dizzy?
This is like a really good comedy, but also the gangster character is kind of scary. And I kind of cribbed something from it for The Sopranos one time. The gangster, when they've come upon him on board, he says, my name is Nick, and this is Nick Jr., and he pulls out his gun.
Hmm.
And in The Sopranos, at one point, we had an Uncle Jr. was talking with his mistress, and
sure.
he said something about, why don't you go check on Junior's Junior? And she goes, underneath the covers.
The Laurel and Hardy reference. Did you receive any mail from anybody who caught that?
No. Not a bit.
It's being revealed here for the first time by David Chase. One of the things I love about this list that you have sent us of movies is that there are a number of very famous names on it, but not necessarily their most famous films. And the next one on your list here is from the director Stanley Kubrick. The movie is Barry Lyndon.
Well, that's my. It's hard to pick it, but that's my favorite Kubrick film.
Director of 2001, director of Paths of Glory, we could go, Dr. Strangelove, we could go on for quite some time, but you find Barry Lyndon to be your favorite Kubrick film. What's it about?
Well, probably his best-known film for people nowadays is The Shining, I guess.
Oh, sure, of course.
What's the film about? Barry Lyndon is a Victorian novel about a young man's trip from, story from like the age of 18 through middle age and his ruin. He's played really wonderfully by Ryan O'Neill. The guy is a rapscallion and a rake and a kind of a scumbag, Barry Lyndon.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to rise up in the world. And the first frame of the first frames of the movie, his father is shot in a duel. And dueling proves to be very important to the whole movie, dueling and warfare. But what's great about it is that with all this violence, there's this overlay of the most civilized conduct, you know, with the handkerchiefs inside the sleeve.
Oh,
and,
sure.
Everybody is called sir. Like when he's held up by some highwayman, they say, good day to you, sir. And can we have that? Please give us your money now.
And now I'm afraid we must get on to the more regrettable stage of our brief acquaintance. Turn around and keep your hands high above your head, please.
That's all the money my mother had in the world. Mightn't I be allowed to keep it?
Mr. Barry, in my profession, we hear many such stories. Yours is one of the most intriguing and touching I've heard in many weeks. Nevertheless, I'm afraid I cannot grant your request. Good day, young sir.
You know, when you talk about a movie that has this elaborate code of honor that is laid on top of a basically violent existence, and you say that's your favorite Kubrick film, I wonder if it in some way informed your production of The Sopranos, where you had people who at least pretended to have this great code of honor as they were doing violent things.
I never thought of it that way, but, you know, I'm sure that's true. Because I remember when we were doing The Sopranos, I used to love that about it, which was that there were rules there was a mafia code that you had to go by. But, of course, the code is ridiculous. It's a code among sociopaths.
You also have on this list a movie called Bicycle Thieves, also just called The Bicycle Thief, 1948.
Yeah, well, that's a really, I mean, that's a classic.
Vittorio De Sica, am I saying his name
correctly?
Vittorio
De Sica, yeah. But the thing about that movie, there's a lot of Italian movies that I love, but the thing about that movie is it's so simple, and the reason I put it down there is because this is what I wish for myself, not that my bicycle would get stolen, but that I wish that I could write something so simple and clear and clean.
It's been years since I've seen it. Let's remind people what it's about. It's a poor guy in Italy.
Yeah, it's right after World War II, and Italy is just over being occupied, I guess, by the Germans. It's extremely poor, and the guy needs his bicycle to get to work, and his bicycle gets stolen. And on a Sunday, he and his son go looking for the bicycle.
And that's the whole plot.
That is it. And it's about the relationship between this boy and his father. It's just the most pure, beautiful, simple thing.
I'm trying to think of what makes it still work as a movie, and it sounds like it's that once you have a very simple story that people can follow, you can hang some very profound issues on it and explore some very profound issues.
That's completely true. I think movies work best, actually, when they almost are at the fairy tale level. You know, I think storytelling is all about children. We human beings love to hear stories being told. And the first happens when you're a kid, and you know, and your father tells you a story at night, or your mother, or your uncle, whoever it is, and you sit there with your mouth open, and your mind goes into these places that they're telling you about that you've never seen, and you're agape. You just can't believe it, that things can happen like that. But it's just so direct.
Well, David Chase, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With Steve Inskeep, writer and director David Chase. Now out on DVD is his newest film, Not Fade Away, a coming-of-age story set in the 60s about a young man with big rock and roll dreams. You can find all of his Watch This recommendations at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm David Green.
Iron Man 3, starring Robert Downey Jr., qualifies as what you might call a double-dip sequel. It's the third movie in the Iron Man series, but it's also a follow-up to The Avengers, presumably the first of many. It opens at midnight at thousands of theaters in this country, but because it opened last week in dozens of other countries, it already has more than $250 million in the bank. Bob Bondello says he hopes that cheers up its leading man.
You know, I think this bummed-out superhero thing is catching. Depressed Bat Guy, brooding Spider Dude, even the Man of Steel seems existentially troubled in previews. And smart-alecky Iron Man is, well, just listen.
I'm Tony Stark. I build neat stuff. I got a great girl. And occasionally, save the world. So why can't I sleep?
Actually, we know why. That Avengers dust-up with the aliens last summer would leave anyone anxious. It's giving Tony Stark panic attacks every time somebody says New York. And now, with his super buddies occupied elsewhere, a pontificating bad guy has surfaced who might as well be named Osama bin Mandarin.
Today is the first day of what's left of your life.
Mandarin keeps blowing stuff up, including innocent civilians, and, well, lack of sleep will make even a superhero say things in public he probably shouldn't.
Here's my home address. 10880 Malibu Point, 90265.
Not the zip code. Now he can find you, which, of course, he does. Happily, Stark's been working on a nifty new Iron Man app that lets him bond with his body armor one knee pad at a time. There are still a few kinks.
Jarvis, where's my flight power?
Working on it, sir. This is a prototype.
But his robot pal is good at working them out in real time, for a while at least. Robert Downey Jr. has always put you're not the boss of me adolescence into playing Stark, so it's fun that Iron Man 3 gives him an actual adolescent to play with, a lonely kid named Harley who finds Iron Man in his garage and treats him a lot like Elliot treated E.T. I'm going to guess that was new writer-director Shane Black's idea. He's the guy who revitalized action movies a couple of decades ago with his script for Lethal Weapon, and his recipe here is similar. Snappy dialogue, momentarily startling plot twists, and lots of stuff blowing up. The film has some fun character-based surprises. Who knew Stark's girlfriend Pepper spent so much time at the gym, for instance? And I don't think this qualifies as a spoiler. An entirely conventional blow-everything-to-smithereens conclusion. Looks like a fireworks display, which is either hubris or simply appropriate for an early May release that has every intention of hanging around theaters until the 4th of July. I'm Bob Mondello.
This is NPR News.
If you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Kelly McEvers. Today is Derby Day, the 139th Kentucky Derby. This race has always been a spectacle. Big hats, big bets, and as Hunter S. Thompson described it, big drinking.
That whole thing, I said, will be jammed with people. 50,000 or so. Most of them staggering drunk. It's a fantastic scene. Thousands of people fainting, crying, copulating, trampling each other. Fighting with broken whiskey bottles.
That's actor Tim Robbins reading from an essay Thompson wrote in 1970 called The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved. The essay chronicles a very boozy weekend, something Thompson later became famous for. And it was this essay that first inspired the term gonzo journalism. Thompson's companion that weekend was British illustrator Ralph Steadman. The two eventually would become lifelong collaborators. All the Fear and Loathing projects, the Rolling Stone articles. The 1970 Derby is the first time the two ever met. Steadman says it took them 2 days to find each other. When they finally did meet, the drinking started almost immediately.
I turned around and this bullet head of a man, huge, 6'4", standing in front of me. He said, "Are you from England?" "Yes." "Are you Hunter S. Thompson?" He said, "Yes, I am. Maybe we should get a beer together and sit down."
Did you ever manage to see the actual race?
Yeah, we went into the inner field first and just to look at the people. We were really looking for odd faces, people that were kind of weird, you know. That seemed to become our real purpose.
He had done a few good sketches, but so far we hadn't seen that special kind of face that I felt we would need for our lead drawing. It was a face I'd seen 1,000 times at every derby I'd ever been to. I saw it in my head as the mask of the whiskey gentry, a pretentious mix of booze, failed dreams, and a terminal identity crisis.
The face of the whiskey gentry. Was that his idea? Was that your idea? Did you guys come up with it together?
No, that was his idea, actually. That's what, you see, he becomes part of the story. And that's what always happened with us. We sort of melded together.
What was it like to work with this guy? I mean, there's this passage in the Kentucky Derby essay where he says you guys got kicked out of a restaurant because of you and your disturbing drawings.
Well,
but actually,
I kept drawing people everywhere I was. I had a habit. I had a compulsion. Still do. A compulsion to draw things. I mean, in a funny sort of way, he was an old-fashioned Kentucky boy. He took me to meet his friends at the Pendennis Club, some guy and his wife, and the wife got sort of interested and she said, "Will you draw me?" So I started drawing her, scribbling her down. She says, "That ain't pretty." "I'm pretty, ain't I?" And Hunter said, "Stop that filthy scribbling, Ralph."
But then you say that it's because he maced the waiter.
Yeah, he did, yeah. Hunter maced people in the restaurant in order to get me out safe.
Good to know. At the end of this essay, Hunter Thompson actually spies the face, you know, that you guys have been looking for this whole time, the whiskey gentry. Let's listen here for a second.
There he was, by God! A puffy, drink-ravaged, disease-ridden caricature, like an awful cartoon version of an old snapshot in some once-proud mother's family photo album. It was the face we've been looking for. And it was, of course, my own.
So it's true. You guys were that depraved by the end of the
week. We were by the end of the week, yeah. He sent me off. I thought I'd never speak to him again.
He kicks you out of the car.
He took me to the airport and said, "Get the hell out of here. You damn scumbag." You know.
Was there a point when the two of you kind of had to make up?
No. I thought I'd never hear from him again. I did go back to England Then I heard from Hunter. Rolf, do you want to come back over here? I said, well, what for? You told me to get out of here. Oh, that was just talk, Rolf, just talk. I think I had a good time, you know. I hope you did. So I said, you know, up to a point, yes. It was great.
You are also the artist for Flying Dog beer labels. I just want to tell you we're cracking open a bottle of that beer right now. Here goes. Ah,
wow. There you go.
In your honor, going to take a little drink here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, bless you. That's lovely. That's great.
Thank you so much. Ralph Steadman, cartoonist, artist, and longtime collaborator with Hunter S. Thompson. Mr. Steadman, thanks again.
Well, bless your heart. Absolutely wonderful speaking to you.
A retrospective of Ralph Steadman's work has just opened at the Cartoon Museum in London, and those recordings you heard of Hunter S. Thompson's essay were released last year with Tim Robbins as Thompson and Mr. Steadman as himself.
American culture is a complex tapestry of art, music, literature, and television. But not just any television, game shows. And not just any game show. Wheel of Fortune first hit TV screens in 1975. The original host was Chuck Woolery.
Just look at this studio filled with beautiful and imaginative gifts, which can be purchased today on Wheel of Fortune. Total retail value of all these prizes, more than $31,000. Now, let's meet the host of Wheel of Fortune, Chuck Woolery.
In 1983, the show was syndicated with host Pat Sajak, who has been deftly guiding millions of Americans through word puzzles for more than 30 years. As the show celebrates its milestone anniversary this season, we thought it was a good chance to get to know the man behind the wheel. We started off talking about how he made the leap from local weather guy to America's favorite game show host. It all started with a phone call from a very important Hollywood name.
Merv Griffin, who owned the show at the time, called me and said, "Hey, you want to do a game show? Chuck's leaving." And it's Merv Griffin on the phone. What am I going to say? I was so excited to hear from him.
Please do not adjust your sets at home. Chuck Woolery has not shrunk. A lot of people are playing with a vertical hold right now. As Jack mentioned, my name is Pat Sajak, and I've been fortunate enough to wander onto the set of a very successful program, has been for a long time.
Honestly, I didn't see myself as a game show host, and I don't even know what I mean by that, but nothing against it. But yeah. If I were to make a list of the 50 things I thought I'd end up doing in broadcasting, you know, game show host would have been 47th or something. So, and I said to Merv, I said, "Look, this is wonderful, but I'm not, you know, back then especially, there was sort of a stereotypical idea of a game show host, the guy smiling, hey, you want $10,000, you know, and I don't really do that, although I did that pretty well just now, didn't I?"
You did. It was really good.
And I said, "Merv, I don't know if it's my style." And he was great. He said, "You know, I like the way you do your local stuff that I see you doing, and that's the way I want you to do it, and don't worry about it, and come do it however you want to do it."
Was Vanna White always with you?
No, there was a woman named Susan Stafford who worked with Chuck for those 7 years, and she stayed for another year after I joined, and then she left, and then happily we found Vanna, who's been great to work with, because we share a certain sensibility, and that is we take our job seriously, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. It's lightning in a bottle. If you ask Vanna what she does for a living, she doesn't go, "Well, I one day I'm going to direct." And yeah. She says, "Hey, I touch letters." You know, I mean, she gets it. She gets the sort of fluky nature of television, and she has fun with it, and she's been great to work with.
I'd like to take a big step back, if you don't mind.
Sure.
To your roots. You were born and raised in Chicago, is that right?
I was indeed, sort of an industrial part of the city. My dad worked on a truck dock unloading trucks 8 hours a day in cold Chicago winters and hot Chicago summers. I always laugh when people say, "How do you keep it fresh after 30 years?" I say, "How did my father keep it fresh?" But yeah, that's I grew up and left there when I was about 20 years old.
I read that you worked for a Spanish radio station. Do you speak Spanish?
let me answer in Spanish. No. You know, it's a funny thing. I was going to school in Chicago, and a friend of mine, an instructor who actually worked in Chicago radio, said, "Listen, I know this guy runs a little station, and they're looking for a guy to do a kind of a rip-and-read newscast from midnight to 6 a.m. Every 5 minutes, you go in and rip the wire thing off and read the top stories." And I go in and talk to him. He had me read a couple of things for him. He said, "You can start tonight." I said, "Great." I show up at midnight. There's not a light in the neighborhood to be found. There's not a light in the studio. There's no one home. I'm banging on the door. A car pulls up, and an Hispanic gentleman gets out and
says something to me in Spanish, which I don't understand. He takes a key and opens it. It turns out he's the disc jockey. It turns out he does a Spanish radio show from midnight to 6 a.m. And it turns out he plays Spanish music, does Spanish commercials. And once an hour, I would do the news in English. To this day, and the only time I knew it was time, he go, Patsajak, and I'd hear my name and I'd start reading. So that was my auspicious debut in radio.
And then you went on, you joined the Army.
I did. I left. I was in college and not doing great and not particularly enjoying it and kind of wanting to get on with my life and career and all that. So instead, I joined the Army, and there was a little thing going on in Vietnam at the time. And I was told by recruiters that if I were to join, that might help my chances of, say, getting into broadcasting and not going to Vietnam, which I wasn't especially anxious to do. But it didn't quite work out that way, and that's where I was sent. And
you were in Saigon, or where were you?
The Army works in strange ways. I took basic training as a clerk typist. Then they made me a finance clerk and sent me to Vietnam. And finally, I managed to get transferred after several attempts to Saigon, where I became the Good Morning Vietnam guy and did that for about a year and a half.
So you actually were like Adrian Cronauer.
I was, in that I yelled that, you know, thing at 6 o'clock every morning, which is dangerous to do in an enemy war zone, by the way. And we tried to make it sound like a stateside radio station. So it was very unmilitary. We played whatever the rock and roll music was at the time. And it was great training for me. And I used to say, this would be a wonderful job, except for all the barbed wire and tanks outside.
So I realize we're going to skip over a lot of years now. But how did you get yourself to Hollywood? And what were your expectations when you landed there the first time?
As a lot of people did when they started in radio, I kind of jumped around from market to market. I worked from Saigon. I went to a little place called Murray, Kentucky. And then I went to the nearest big city. I said, my career is going terribly. I got to do something. And I went to, and that was Nashville.
How old were you at the time?
I was 23, I guess. Okay. And I was banging on all the doors of the radio television stations in Nashville. And finally, someone got sick of my banging and hired me to be a staff announcer in Nashville. And I was there for several years. And they needed a weatherman out in Los Angeles, and suddenly found myself as the weatherman in Los Angeles for about 5 years, which immediately led to Wheel, because when you're working in local TV in L.A., in a way you're auditioning every night because the producers are at home watching TV like everybody else, and happily one of those guys was Merv Griffin, and he took a shine to me, as they say, and next came Wheel.
Did you grow up watching game shows?
I wouldn't call myself a game show groupie, but I like the panel shows. There used to be a class of celebrity, and I don't exactly know who they were. People like Orson Bean and Peggy Cass and people on shows like What's My Line, they were sort of actors. They were sort of conversationalists. They weren't comics, you know. They were not performers in that sense, but they were smart. They were funny. You felt like you were at a dinner party with these people. So I liked those kinds of shows. I didn't have game shows on from dawn to dusk, but I liked some of the guys who did the show, so many shows for so many years, guys like Bob Barker and guys like Bill Cullen. I admired them as broadcasters. I thought they were terrific.
I guess I wonder, though, it's the same thing every time. It's three contestants. They get, 10 seconds to tell you their life story. You play the game. What are the moments in that formula? Yeah. It is a formula for a show that you still find exciting.
Therein lies the challenge and what makes it exciting for me. How do I take show number 5,286 and three more housewives from Teaneck, New Jersey, nice people who have a little story to tell and have two kids who want you to know about them and are going to play hangman? I think I treat each entity, each show, as an important piece of television, and I don't think that I don't treat it as show number 5,280. I treat it as my job for that moment.
Matt Cox, Bowie, Maryland.
Yes, sir.
What do you do there?
Systems engineer.
Mm-hmm. And an engaged fella, huh?
I am. Be married soon to a wonderful woman.
I treat everyone, I think, with respect, and I try to have fun. I try to put them at ease. And I really care what happens to them. I mean, look, I don't care who wins. I just want everyone to leave with a good experience. And I really work at that. And if there's anything I bring to the show, I think it's that.
Another 30 years, then, for you?
Sure. if that's what you want, you may have to come adjust my drool cup, but that'll be fine.
Pat Sajak, celebrating 30 years as host of Wheel of Fortune, better known as Wheel to those who watch often. He joined us from NPR West in Culver City. Mr. Sajak, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Rachel. Great fun.
This is Weekend Edition, which is directed by Gemma Waters and produced by Peter Breslow, Chris Benderev, Tom Bullock, Wilma Consul, Tom Dreisbach, Nayantara Mukherjee, and Caitlin Dickerson. Barry Hardiman, Jeff Bennett, and Bridget McCarthy edit the program. Zach Coleman provides engineering support, and our technical director is Brian Jarbo. The web producer is Mel Goh. Today's show was produced by Ned Wharton. The supervising producer is Sarah Oliver, and our senior supervising producer is Bridget Kelly. I'm Rachel Martin.